Good morning. Be seated, everyone. Our first case, State of Washington versus Vernon Walker. Are parties ready to proceed on that matter?
We are indeed. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thomas Kemmerer appearing on behalf of Mr. Walker, and I'm going to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Essentially, there's two issues this morning. One, whether there's a right to be free from shackling at sentencing. Two, and we contend that there is. And two, whether the state has proven that Mr. Walker should have been shackled. We argue today that they did not. Essentially, the argument is, and it comes from the U.S. Constitution. Deck versus Missouri makes a very clear point. One of the reasons why people are free from shackling during court proceedings is for the decorum, dignity and decorum of the judicial proceedings and the respect of the individual. You find that in Deck, and you find that repeatedly in the decisions, not only from the Illinois courts, but the California courts that I cited.
Now, that's a reason for not shackling, but you're not contending, I assume, that there's an absolute right, because obviously there isn't an absolute right even at trial.
No. Any constitutional right is allowed some burden or alteration to it, yes, no question. But
what you're saying is that there should be a constitutional presumption, at least.
At least, yes. At least. I mean, you look at the cases that
or
talk about
it. Or any other case in front of a judge?
Yes.
At any other case when a person is in court?
Yes, absolutely. Any time a person appears in court, they should be free from, there should be a presumption that the person should be free from shackling, absent some showing by the state that this person has to be shackled. That's the argument that we're making.
And do you think there's no case that says that that much?
There are plenty of cases that say that. But what ends up happening is it's only in those instances where there's a jury present. You see all of the cases cited. In fact, Deck is a case where the jury was present. They were extending the right to be free from shackling from the trial proceedings to the guilt phase proceedings in a death penalty case. And they made the point that the same analysis applies not only for the trial phase where the jury's there, but for the guilt phase as well, because it's not just a question of guilt or innocence. There's more than that. It's the fairness of the proceedings and the dignity and decorum and all of that. So that's the point I think we have to understand is everything seems to be focused in that direction, and the reason I cited the Illinois and California cases is because they point out that those cases, those states have extended it beyond just jury-based proceedings, that also to, in California, preliminary hearings where there is, it's in front of a judge, there is no jury. Juvenile court proceedings.
So in Washington, you're saying that there needs to be a rule that states at least that there is a constitutional presumption.
Absolutely.
That's what you're after.
Absolutely.
And then you would say that it can be overcome, but that in this case, you're going to say for your client it wasn't.
Absolutely.
All right.
That's the argument precisely in this case. Yes.
Is California the only case that has gone?
I cited some cases from Illinois, too, which one of them is a competency proceeding where there was no jury present. But there's a couple of Illinois cases, a couple of California cases, and that's.
But did Illinois also base it on a constitutional presumption or?
They followed Deck and the federal constitution. Yes, once again, based on that dignity and decorum and respect for the individual, more respect for the individual than anything else. I mean, the individual should have the opportunity to be in court before the judge, unshackled, absent some showing by the state that they can't.
And remind me, I mean, forgive me for asking, but what part of the Constitution is the source of this? Is it
Deck talks about the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments, so it'd be the 14th Amendment due process. And there's cases in Washington that talk about Article 1, Section 22, but I didn't make a gun wall, and I'm not making a separate state constitutional argument. It's strictly under the federal constitution. Turning to the show.
Not Washington case. I'm sorry, keep interrupting. Washington case that comes close to saying what you want to have as your starting point here?
Off the top of my head, yes. As long as I can find it.
You can find it later if you want to.
The Hartzog is the one I'm thinking of. Hartzog is the one that talks about it.
Comes the closest.
I mean, once again, it's judicial proceeding. It's a proceeding where the jury is present, and the focus on a lot of these is the prejudice to the defendant. Finch is another one. That's the death penalty case. Yeah, yeah. Finch is the other one that talks about shackling. And once again, the focus is on the jury proceedings because of the prejudice to the individual being shackled in front of the jury. But turning to the showing by the state showed clearly that Mr. Walker does not do well in jail. No problem. I mean, that's fine. But they didn't show anything that Mr. Walker ever acted out in court. He pled guilty. He was here for the sentencing. It was a lengthy sentencing because he wanted he sought a exceptional down for fecal alcohol syndrome. But they didn't show anything that he acted out in court, that there was some reason why he had to be shackled in court based on his behavior in court. So based on that...
Are you proposing that be the rule, that you have to show misconduct in court rather than predict misconduct based on conduct elsewhere?
Well, I think that certainly helps. I would be loath just to base it on misconduct elsewhere, absent some showing. I mean, the worst...
You're advocating a one free outburst rule.
I try that again.
A one free outburst rule. You can't be restrained in court until you have done at least something wrong inside the courtroom.
In a sense, yes, because of the presumption that you should be able to appear unshackled.
Well, that really can't be the rule because, even in the jury cases, I mean, if people are, dangerous, if there's a reason to think they're going to escape, if they have accomplices around, all of that stuff.
And I think the more egregious the conduct outside of court, the less there has to be shown about what's happening in court. So if you have somebody who's a real danger or an escape risk or something like that, certainly that weighs pretty heavily toward shackling. And I'll just reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Donna Wise, representing the state of Washington. It is the state's position that due process does not require a presumption that restraints are inappropriate for a judicial sentencing. Counsel has stated there should be a right not to be in restraints. That doesn't mean due process requires a presumption of prejudice. The Deck case mentions visible restraints many times, as I point out in my brief, and specifically says, historically, the rule does not apply to proceedings before a judge.
Who do you think should make the decision in proceedings before the judge?
I think as they refer to it in the case of the security service, whoever's providing security should make that decision. Then, because the presumption, as I talk about in my briefing in front of a judge, is that they won't be prejudiced by things that are potentially inflammatory, like...
But isn't it true that we have in many areas of the law this emphasis on, what kind of a place the courtroom should be? I mean, you have, remember there's that Supreme Court case that doesn't want trials to be held in jail. And you have all of this language, very strong language in these cases involving juries, and much of it has to do with what it looks like. And it seems to me that if you don't have some kind of a presumption that gets the judge involved in making the decision about the individual case, you end up with a routine practice of people coming in chains, no matter how innocuous their crimes, how young they are. Isn't it a constitutional concern for a court to think about how that looks to the general public and just what kind of an atmosphere that creates for the judicial decision makers and the officers of the court to have these people parading through routinely every week, every calendar, in chains?
No, I don't think it's a problem, Your Honor, and I don't think a judge needs to get involved before a defendant comes into court in restraints. You talked about, I believe it's the Yates case, I'm not sure about the name, that involved a jail courtroom. That problem in that case was that the jury was going to the jail for the trial. The problem was not that there was a hearing in the jail. Every day we had all of our initial appearance hearings and many, I believe, municipal court hearings as well, in a courtroom in the jail here. No one has raised any complaint that there's something prejudicial about that that violates due process. Now,
so is it your position that outside of jury proceedings that the court should defer to the judgment of jail officials about how defendants shall appear before them, shackles or not?
I'm not saying that they should defer. I'm just saying that the issue is not raised unless the defense raises it. In other words, if the defense raises an issue in a particular case and says, gee, these are painful to me, or I'm unable to communicate with my attorney for some reason, or there's a particular reason why it's a problem with a particular hearing or with the restraints that are being used, then the judge should address it and not defer to anyone, consider the relevant issues. But
and I suppose you would say that because the right that's argued is a due process right, which is the individual right. I mean, you know, what's kind of influencing my thinking, I guess, as I sit here thinking about it, is it's almost like the open court's jurisprudence, because you have one kind of right that belongs to the defendant, but you also have the public right.
Well, I will say that no court has ever recognized that the public's right extends to due process. Now, if you look at, there is no case, and I'll address those California and Illinois cases in a second, but there is no case that says there's an inherent prejudice to appearing in restraints in front of a judge. The Ninth Circuit.
What about today's world where you show up in a preliminary appearance and there's either an artist or a cameraman there, and the front page of the paper then shows someone in restraints in a jumpsuit who hasn't been convicted of any crime, and there's been no demonstration of dangerousness, there just has been a procedure?
Well, you know, the reality is in the King County Courthouse, people are marched through the hallways in their restraints and their jumpsuits every day.
That's the reality. That doesn't mean it's the right answer.
Well, again, we're talking about prejudicial publicity. That's a different issue. Again, we're talking about a due process. Is there a due process presumption of prejudice in appearing before a judge with restraints?
People frequently have never consulted with the lawyer. They may meet a lawyer for the first time at the preliminary appearance and have a brief conversation. And they haven't been convicted of anything. They've only been arrested. Sometimes they haven't even been charged with a crime yet. And we defer to security people to just routinely put all of them in shackles.
Your Honor, again, you might think that as a policy is not a good policy. But that doesn't mean that due process presumes that it's prejudicial. In fact, that's what the Ninth Circuit said. They were talking about preliminary hearings, and they said a judge is not prejudiced by seeing a defendant with restraints. And that's the question here. Is due process presuming prejudice?
You know, I guess part of the question that is in my mind, I can see in an individual case, yes, a judge can set it aside. But what is the cumulative effect? And I realize that question is not directly presented here, but what is the cumulative effect on officers of the court, the judge and everybody else, the lawyers who are in there, if it's a routine practice?
Well, I think speaking as
isn't
someone who's
different?
Been a prosecutor for almost 30 years, the cumulative effect is you don't pay any attention to it at all. Because you see it all the time, and that's what Judge Lum said. He said, I've been a judge for a long time. I've seen defendants in all kinds of uniforms. I've seen defendants in all kinds of restraints. It has no effect on me at all. And when you know, look at what happened in this case,
for example. I know there's a lot of situations where people say, you know, it has no effect on me at all. I mean, you know, we're kind of talking broadly here. I'm remembering my days in the legislature when, you know, people would routinely take very large campaign contributions from people, and they would say, you know, this has no effect on me at all. You know, I mean, I think the public is entitled to question broad statements from people who are in a system and who are doing, you know, doing a practice that has been accepted for ages.
Well, I have to say,
you know, it has no effect on me at all.
Here's the other side of the point Judge Spearman raised, though. If what the court is doing is not taking part in the decision-making and just allowing the defendants to appear as they appear, there is no presumption to be drawn, no inference to be drawn from how they appear. What happened in this case, and what the only claim of prejudice in this case, is that because the issue was raised, the parties litigated it. And the jail came in and they said, well, let's talk about why we have these restraints on. He's been convicted of murder and assault, too, in the current case. He fled. He fled to Canada. He fought extradition for 7 years. So he is an escape risk. He is a risk of danger. In addition to this current assault, while he was in Canada in flight, he committed another felony assault. He had another felony assault on his record. How is this man not dangerous, and
well,
how is he not an escape
risk? Well, you have a
pretty
good case, I have to admit, when you get to the second part of the analysis. And I guess that's why we're talking about the first part, the presumption, whether there should be one.
Well,
that requires a little bit more individual consideration, as was given in this case.
Well, that sort of leads to an interesting point, because what I was saying was that if it's not litigated, then the judge doesn't hear that he also had infractions in the jail. He was fighting in the jail here and in Canada. He was taking his bracelet off. He was threatening other inmates. If that hadn't been litigated, the judge would have never heard any of that and would have assumed less than what he actually knew. Now, the defense hasn't made the argument, well, this judge has to recuse himself because he's heard all this information, because, as I pointed out, in bench trials, the judge is presumed to be able to set that aside. You're a professional person. You know what's inappropriate to consider. You don't consider it. You don't consider the fact that I'm a woman. You just don't consider it. Now, I want to address those California and Illinois cases quickly, just because they don't say what the defendant says they did. In Booz versus Illinois, which was the competency hearing case, it was a hearing before a jury. The juvenile case in Illinois, the court did not rely on a constitutional analysis. That was a Staley case. The Seventh Circuit, as I pointed out in my brief, specifically says that was not a constitutionally based ruling. And then the Illinois Supreme Court actually adopted a rule that says the presumption against shackling only applies to trial proceedings in which innocence or guilt is going to be determined. So it's not the rule in Illinois. Likewise, in California, the Fierro case is based on, at least in part, a California codification of the right to be free of restraints. And this is the other interesting thing about it. It does not presume prejudice. So it does not conclude that there's inherent prejudice. That also related to a preliminary hearing. It said the defendant has to show prejudice to get relief. And the state's not arguing if there is some prejudice, the defendant doesn't get relief. The state's arguing that there's no presumption of prejudice when there's a hearing that's in front of a judicial officer. That's long been the rule that applies to bench trials, and that's the rule that should be applied in this case. Thank you.
Judge Becker, I think you touched a nerve there. Have we become so inured that we don't even notice when people are shackled? I mean, has it come to that we don't even notice that?
If we don't notice, how does your client demonstrate prejudice?
Well, that's the point. I think we do notice because people that are coming in the system, we're assuming certain things. And that's what we're assuming, is this person's dangerous because they're shackled. Everyone's shackled. Everyone's dangerous that's coming into the system. And that's a separate society, and yet we're willing to accept that. We're willing to accept that everyone is shackled. Everyone's in orange outfits. Everyone in society is not shackled. Everyone in society is not wearing an orange jumpsuit. The people should be treated individually. And so the argument
is your position that in this particular case that in order before Mr. Walker could have been brought to court in shackles, the state would have had to make a motion for that to occur?
Yes. I think to go back to what Judge Becker originally said, what we're arguing is a presumption of not being shackled, absent some showing by the state that they should be shackled. So unless the court has any other questions, we would just ask the court to reverse and remand for resentencing. Thank you.